Welcome to the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, a companion series to the blockbuster exhibit, The State of Sound, a world of music from Illinois, now playing at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum.
Welcome to the State of Sound podcast. I'm Dave Hoekstra from Springfield, Illinois, in the museum, and our guest is Shay Mayfield, the son of the great Curtis Mayfield, who's now managing the Mayfield Estate. How you doing there, Shay?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us. You know what a fan I am of your father's work. I want to start maybe I sent you a piece I did for the Sun-Times where I came down and visited your dad in Georgia. I think you might have been 11 or 12, but what are your memories of growing up with your father?
A lot of memories, of course. Just I don't think anything that was out of the ordinary between any father-son relationship. I have several siblings, which I grew up with in the same home. I remember the piece that you wrote when you sent to me earlier. I was reading it, and I was like, yeah, I remember around that time, I think I was probably, I want to say maybe 13, because I think I was just going into high school. And just reading the setting and all that really took me back as far as being around that time and being around my dad around that time, because that was not too long after his accident. So, right. But yeah, growing up with my father, there's a lot of interest that him and I both shared as far as music and other hobbies. Like, he was a real big technology person, as I was too. So we shared a lot of common interests, and we spent a lot of time together growing up. So
I want to talk to you a little bit about the process of him writing songs, but for people who may not be that familiar with him, talk about his songbook. And one thing I tried to do with the exhibit is just to tell people how his music and his message may it resonates so much today. So talk about some of the songs he did and how relevant they are in today's world.
Well, there's a lot of songs that, especially off of his solo debut album, which a lot of people refer to it as the Yellow Pants album, where he's sitting there with the yellow suit on, and you can kind of, the angle is like from his leg going up, the Curtis album. And a lot of those songs were basically written off of personal experiences that he experienced, not only growing up, but also traveling with the Impressions. He was traveling around that time. Of course, there was still a lot of states that had these Jim Crow laws and there are segregation hotels and restaurants still kind of going on. They couldn't stop everywhere and stay the night if they needed to. They couldn't stop anywhere, everywhere, and eat if they had to. So a lot of those songs kind of resonate today, because there are, of course, segregation has now been outlawed and is illegal, but there's still many of the experiences that people go through and today that kind of mirror the segregation of the, prior to the civil rights movement. So when a lot of younger generation, younger people like myself, hear these lyrics and they stop and think, they're like, wow, this has been going on for a while. And it's still really relatable to, from what it was back before, all of these laws and such were passed.
Your dad stayed contemporary. When I visit him, you just talked about technology. He stayed contemporary with technology. Stayed contemporary with what other artists were doing. What was his views of the world there as you were growing up?
Well, as far as, when things change as far as music and you're of a certain age, of course, the a lot of the younger stuff, you're not going to, the taste is just a little different. And he wasn't really too fond of some of the newer stuff that the kids and us kids were listening to. But there were some of it especially in his final album, The New World Order, he tried to incorporate such a more contemporary sound with his songwriting. It was another aspect of the technology part that he used when, I think going through the 80s and early 90s, was he got into like drum machine programming and other, you know, sounds and synthesizers that he used in his music to try and make it a little more contemporary. Of course, those albums weren't as successful as the more organic writing style that he had prior to, I think, maybe the late 70s and such. So, you know, it was his view of all of the of the world at that time was you know, kind of, I don't know, a little all over the place, or anything, or what we had talked about anyway.
For listeners who may not know, talk briefly about his accident, but what I want to make the question specific is when I went to visit him, talk about the changes in the way he had to adapt to making music after the accident, because that goes into technology. I remember him talking about it. I'll never, you know, I did a lot of interviews for the Sun-Times in 30 years, and your father's like right up there at the top. I just remember being in that living room. It's like it happened yesterday. I was looking here, it was 1993, but
yeah,
being in that living room, and oh man, I was bedside. I was with him for a couple hours, and he was just so generous with his time and so eloquent. And I remember when we talked about People Get Ready, he had a tear coming down his eyes. But anyway, talk about the accident and how he had to adapt to that, you know, artistically.
So the accident was, I know a lot of, not everybody, but I do get a lot of questions from fans about what exactly happened, which was, of course, he just got on stage for a outdoor concert in Brooklyn, New York, when the portable lighting had fell because of a storm that was passing through. And of course, left him as a quadriplegic to where he couldn't move anything below his neck, below his shoulders. He had a very, I know you mentioned this in the piece that you had sent me, the article you wrote, he did have a very, very faint movement in his left arm, but, you know, it could basically kind of swing it back and forth, but that was it. You know, nothing really, he couldn't really do anything with his arm. He could just sway it. So, you know, of course, when something like that happens, like overnight, you just lose complete control over your body and have to rely on other people 24/7. You know, of course, you're going to go through a range of emotions, you know, sadness, anger, and things of that nature. When he finally got back to the point where he wanted to write songs again, of course, he had a lot of good people that, you know, obviously wanted to work with him, and they would come in, he would jot down, he'd have them jot down ideas on, you know, legal pads or, you know, anything that they're usually legal pads. That's what he liked to use. And, you know, they start piecing them together. Then they come in and start writing melodies. And, you know, they have there was one time where he was someone who was working for him who had brought in a little keyboard while she played chords, and they worked out melodies and such to write, you know, to put these songs together, which was much of the process of how he worked before the accident. So uh-huh. Before the accident, he would usually sit down with his legal pad with a couple of lyrics, you know, kind of scribbled together, a couple of verses, and then he kind of work out little melodies with his guitar. You know, usually just sit there on the floor, and he'd be surrounded with papers, and he'd have his guitar there and sit there and kind of just work stuff out. So it was much of the same, except, of course, he couldn't, you know, he couldn't move, so he had to rely on other musicians to kind of help him piece the songs together. And that's pretty much how his, you know, the final album, New World Order, which was released in 1996, had was produced and came together.
We're going to play a little couple little samples from that in a little bit. But I pulled out, I asked him, and here's what he said about his life after the accident. And you probably read this, but your dad said, Curtis Mayfield, "It allows me to think, observe, look back, and still have foresight. I can still carry on as some type of protector and provider in spite of myself. Sometimes I think of it as a man who has died, but who is still able to look back, see himself in the world, and see the people who loved him. I'm glad to be living. Otherwise, I never would have had a chance to see that." Man, it gives me goosebumps. It's kindness. And just, you know, you and I were talking, just talk about what he was like as a father and as a family man and his spirit. And his spirit was unbending even after the accident, as you just heard there.
Well, yeah, even so him as a family man, I know before the accident happened, he was much like being with his children, he was kind of like a big kid, because we used to go to amusement parks, and you know, he would kind of indulge in a lot of the things that we kids would indulge in. Like he'd buy video games for us, and he'd sit there and play with them for a little bit before just letting us play with them. And he'd spend a lot of time doing when he wasn't working, just doing things that either watching movies with us, telling stories sometimes. He was a bit of a prankster, so there would be times he would sneak up on us with these. He had these Halloween masks that he kept in his closet. So it'll be one night we'd be watching TV with the lights off, and he'd come right in around the corner and just scare the bejesus out of everybody. And he'd have a good laugh that way. So, then even after the accident, you know, he still had that same sense of, he wanted to spend time with his kids. He wanted to, I know him and I, when I really got started, finding my musical voice as far as taste, and we realized that we both had the same kind of taste in music, then we had a lot of conversations about different artists, like different jazz artists, instruments, and periods of jazz and clubs that he's gone to before. He'd tell me some of the experiences he's had. He told me he wanted to at one point he tried to play in a jazz band very early on. He was like, "Yeah, I tried, but I couldn't really keep up with them because it was one of those. That's one of the things that him and I had a really close bond about. It was music."
Have you, your dad led almost a reverse migration. He was one of the first artists I knew. Now, I knew Major Lance had moved down there. I went down one time for the Reader. I drove down in an old beat-up Dodge to interview Major Lance. I'm going to go with this in a minute. But your dad, there seemed to be a migration of Chicago artists moving from Chicago down to Atlanta. Have you talked to the current mayor? Have you talked to the current mayor of Atlanta? Tell the listeners who that is.
No, I have not been able to speak with Keisha Lance Bottoms, who's the daughter of Major Lance. I remember it was a couple of years ago, we were trying to make arrangements to meet with her, because I remember we were downtown at one of the government buildings for I can't remember what it was. We were down there, but she was supposed to come and meet with us. But I remember this was a period of time when the city of Atlanta had been hacked by hackers, and there was everybody in there was scrambling, and she couldn't come because she was going through meetings trying to get all the data back and get all this resolved. So I think that's the closest I've gotten to, the closest chance I've gotten to meeting with the mayor of Atlanta, who I don't think I knew was Major Lance's daughter until a couple of days before we went down there. And I was like, oh yeah, that is, I never just didn't put the two pieces together. And
tell the listeners, your dad wrote the Monkey
Time.
He
wrote Monkey Time and several. And one of the things, the first memory that came to me of Major Lance when I heard it and put two and two together. So he used to call the house when I was a kid, and I can remember sometimes answering the phone, and it was like, "Hello, can I speak to Curtis?" And I was like, yes, who's calling? And said, this is Major Lance. And of course, at that time, I had no idea who he was. I just knew it was another name who was, another person who was calling my dad. And it wasn't until later on when I grew up, I was like, oh, yeah, that's who that is. And then, you start putting the pieces together. So, yeah, Major Lance, he worked closely with my dad in Chicago. He was one of the artists. And, of course, Monkey Time. I still hear that song when I drive my mom around to the store or whatever. She likes to keep it on the satellite, the soul. What is it called? The soul. They're playing
Soul Town.
Yeah, right. Soul Town. And every now and then, Monkey Time comes on, and you can hear there's a real particular style that is recognizable as, Curtis Mayfield. And this is with all of the artists that he wrote for. You hear it, you're like, yeah, that's I recognize that style. So whenever you hear like a song by either Major Lance or even Jerry Butler, it's like, yeah, that's a Curtis Mayfield track. Cause it's just a particular sound that you recognize.
Tell the listeners, they grew up together in the Cabrini homes. I mean, they were friends for a long time.
Yeah, they were personal friends. Like I said, you call the house pretty often. Major Lance is calling, and I don't think I ever got the chance to meet him. If I did, I may have been too young to remember it. But it's unmistakable.
He was, went down there to see him, he was trying to resurrect his career. It was a little bit at the end of the disco era. So I think he missed your dad. So talk about, I just went through the exhibit for the first time. It's just, again, it's so nice to see your father featured in this. So talk about the items that are on loan from you guys for the State of Sound here at the Lincoln Museum in Springfield.
So yeah, we were contacted by the Lincoln Museum, and they asked if they explained to me what they were doing, and I suggested, well, anything from that period of time, the 70s in Chicago soul, one of the most, of course, when you hear Curtis Mayfield, most fans are immediately going to think of the soundtrack Superfly, and Superfly was course released in 1972. It was nominated for a Grammy Award, I think in 72 or 73. It didn't win, but even we got my dad got a plaque set from the Recording Academy. And even I'm actually sitting in the room at my mother's house with all of his trophies and awards, and there were two other songs that were also nominated, which was Freddy's Dead and Junkie Chase off of that particular soundtrack. And I thought it would be a very if very important piece of memorabilia, because it was his most famous work, and probably considered by many his greatest work. I was, you know, it got really favorable reviews from the critics. There were, you know, there's even some articles that have called it the greatest soundtrack of all time. I can't remember what magazine had wrote the article with that. They had, I think, 100 soundtracks, 100 greatest soundtracks of all time, and Superfly was number one. So I think that was very significant. And the other piece that we also had sent was an actual music chart from It's All Right. Could have been sung with either him in solo or likely with the Impressions, because there were, I can't remember which chart I sent. It may have been the drums or a trumpet, but there's a huge, you know, huge chart that they would give the musicians to play the music, which was, I know he told me about, as far as his process of writing music, he didn't always write out as far as the notes when he was writing songs, but he had a couple of musician friends that would help him out to put the charts together. I know, like, I think Johnny Pate did the arrangements on Superfly. I'm not sure how early he worked with him or if he was involved with creating that chart there, but...
He was.
Really? Yeah, so...
Yeah, I've got, actually, I brought my article in. Again, I never did this with, sorry to cut in there, but I never did this with many artists, but I did it with your dad. I went through, like, I won't read them all here, but I went through, like, 4 songs and had him talk about the process.
So, oh, wow.
Here's what he said about It's All Right, just part of it. I can send this to you, the full thing, but I brought it back to Chicago, and as we were preparing to record it, I asked session arranger Johnny Pate to give me some horn riffs from a Bobby Blue Bland song, which was Ain't Nothing You Can Do, I Love So Much. The riffs were different, yet they were similar, and they locked in so beautifully. I was praying and thanking God all night because you knew in your heart you had a respectful song. You know, your dad, I maybe interviewed him a couple times on the phone and that one time in person, but he always ended up his statement with a message of empathy and dignity. It's just, even there, he had a respectful song that was important to him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's all right. I remember I spoke with one of the members of the Impressions during the plaque dedication in Chattanooga, Tennessee, which is where I think they live now. And it said many of the songs that they wrote back then were, you know, they could be in the middle of a conversation and someone would maybe say something and it would spark spark creativity. And, like, I think they were having a conversation with maybe somebody was venting about somebody, something, or, you know, something that was going on. And so I was like, no, well, don't worry, Curtis. It's all right. It's all right. It's okay. And he took that. He's like, okay, it's all right. So then it became a song, and a very, you know, popular song that he's known for with singing the Impressions with. So, yeah, that's another important piece of memorabilia that I thought the people of Chicago would like to see.
It's right here, and it's just really important to see this stuff. So thank you. Thank you so much for loaning us that stuff. A couple other things, and I'll let you go. Thanks for being so generous with your time. I want to get back a couple points on the civil rights stuff. I was going to read you, I lied. I do want to talk, read a quote he gave me from Keep on Pushing. But I was talking to a reporter yesterday, and I was telling her about This Is My Country. I don't know if you know much about that song, but
yeah.
The Sun-Times sent me, this is a story I told her. The Sun-Times sent me to D.C., and this is another thing that will always stick in my mind. They sent me to D.C. for the first Obama inauguration in 2008. And the night before the inauguration, we went to a soul food restaurant called Marvin, and it was a tribute to Marvin Gaye because, mm-hmm. You know, he's from D.C. And I'll just always remember, I mean, you know what it was like. There was energy. There was positive vibes. It was just, it wasn't like a new world. It was just, there was so much excitement in D.C., and the restaurant was packed, and people were just so full of positive anticipation. And we sat down, and no sooner did we sit down and make our order than "This Is My Country" comes on blaring through the restaurant. Just completely moved me. And again, I was telling this reporter, positive, you know, forward thinking, those horn charts, just uplifting and stuff. What do you know about that song? I mean, you know, he did so many songs about the movement, but that's one that always sticks in my mind.
I mean, there's a lot of his earlier songs I never really got the opportunity to sit down and just talk in depth with him about, why'd you write this? What were you trying to say when you wrote this? But I always took the "This Is My Country" as something like a statement of saying, look, I was born here. I'm a citizen as well. And this is my country too. You can't sit there and live by one rule and then expect me to live by a totally different rule that's beneath yours. So, I've always took that as, that's what the song meant. Because, that's the point he was trying to make. You know, this is my country too. It's not just for you and you, but it's also, it's mine as well. So I think that's where, the main message of that song, of what that song is. I know a rendition I heard back in 2012, when they did a tribute concert in the Lincoln Center in New York.
And was it that too? Yeah.
New York, yeah. And Mavis Staples sung that song. I remember I was sitting there, sitting next to my wife, and she was like, "Is this one of your dad's songs?" I was like, "Yeah, this is the song he wrote with the Impressions." And she was like, "Oh, wow." And she was just kind of, she was really kind of in awe of the song, and just, of course, she wasn't that familiar with that particular song, but it was, you can see like kind of a moving sense, especially when it was being sung by Mavis Staples, who has an unmistakable, very distinctive sound. And it was a really, really good tribute.
And then Keep on Pushing in 1964. Okay. I need new glasses. 1964. Keep on Pushing.
Keep on Pushing. Keep on Pushing is actually, I actually did have a conversation about Keep on Pushing with him when I was a kid. I asked him about the song and the album cover. So there's two things, me being a kid and see Keep on Pushing and they're standing behind a car like they're pushing it. So I asked him about the car and of course
the album cover. Right?
The album cover. Like, so what happened to the car? Did it break down or something? Is that why he had to keep on pushing it? And so he actually explained to me what they meant by keep on pushing it. And he gave me a little sort of a civil rights, little lesson and some of the things that he had to go through. So I was like, then he went on about the car. It was there was another thing him and I had in common. We both like cars. We both like to drive. And he was like, "Yeah, that car it was a Shelby Cobra. That thing was so fast." And it's like I let my friends borrow it, and they ended up tearing it up. So, well, he was like, "But it was a good thing that they did, because you probably wouldn't have been born, because I was very reckless in that car." So that's where the Keep on Pushing thing comes from.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
Here's what he said, I guess just a little bit. He said, "I wrote it as a gospel song during the civil rights struggles. This reflected on lifting oneself by the bootstraps. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, 'God gave me my strength,' I said, 'I've got my strength, and it doesn't make sense to not keep on pushing.' I hope that is in many people's minds, black and white."
Yeah. So,
great stuff. Two more things. What's going on with the estate? Is there any projects, anything on the horizon you want to talk about?
Well, as far as that, you know, we're trying to get things going again after this, pandemic. We've got a couple of projects, going with Warner Rhino, with a little re-release of a vinyl. So recently, I think earlier this year, we released a limited edition red vinyl Superfly. We should be releasing a couple more albums. I know there's supposed to be Burnt Orange Roots, which is one of my personal favorite albums of his. And my mother's written a book about her experience with my father, especially her experience taking care of my father for the almost 10 years after the accident. Mm-hmm. And we're in the process of, negotiating with publishers and whatnot. She just finished the book not too long ago. So hopefully that'll be being released relatively soon. And we're also working on a new documentary that's, officially released by the Curtis Mayfield Estate. So hopefully there'll be more insight about not just his music, but also just the Curtis Mayfield as a person, which, of course, he was a very, very private person. And, we won't be giving, too much stuff away, but, just to give a little insight on the man who is behind the music. So those are some of the notable projects that will be, that we've been working on and hopefully will be released not too far in the future.
Just the warmest of souls, really, really, really was, and he is. Everybody needs to listen to his music. I asked you to pick a couple songs, so we'll sign off, and maybe you can set up a song. I know we'll only play a few, 10 seconds of it, but you picked something from New World. I was actually playing this in my van on the way over here and stuff. Here But I'm Gone.
Yeah.
So you also mentioned We Gotta Have Peace from Roots album. So pick one of those songs and tell them why they resonate with you.
Man, so Here But I'm Gone was off of his last album that I actually got to see, created, from start to finish. And I remember when he wrote the song, he went to the studio, recorded the song, then they sent the lyrics off to producers Organized Noise, who created the track behind it. And I remember when they first got the CD back, and the very first time that he listened to the finished product, we were all sitting there in his room. So he puts it on and we're listening to it. And I was like, wow, I really like this song. And, he was like, really? You like that? So your old man did good, huh? So, being a teenager, it's like, you're trying to be hip or whatever. But, that song, really, I listened to that song a lot. Cause he gave me a copy of it. So when I was driving to school or driving to work or whatever, I was playing that song and actually the whole album. And the We Gotta Have Peace song off of the Roots album. Now, the very first time I heard this song was him performing live. And I think it was the Montreal Festival in like 1987. Or maybe 80, it was 87, I think. And so it was years after that where I heard the studio recording on the Roots album, which I really took to. And We've Gotta Have Peace is probably one of the first songs that I had learned the lyrics to, because I sat there, I played the song, I wrote the lyrics down, I stopped it, rewinded it, so I could learn the song. And then, just hearing the song off of the Roots album, so it just, you know, it really resonated with me because it was just like, you know, why can't we all just get along and have peace, you know?
Sure.
So those are like some of my, you know, all time favorite songs that really resonate with me personally.
Wow. Well, thank you, Shay Mayfield, for being so generous with sharing those stories. It was very touching.
Oh, any time.
It gave our listeners some insight. You got to come up here from Georgia.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's open through January 2022. January 23rd. So you got plenty of time to come up here.
Okay, yeah, definitely. I'd definitely love to check that out.
This has been the State of Sound podcast produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. To hear other episodes and more information about the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, visit musicfromillinois.com.